Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know our drill. We're recording Tuesday on Monday morning. An article came out over the weekend, and it is a tribute to my good friend and my personal hero, Art Ellison. And I thought I would share part of this incredible tribute about him with you, in part because he's not just a hero for New Hampshire, he's a hero for a nation. And he's what we want more people to be, and what we want our public officials to be, and what we want our elected officials to be, because they understand who they serve and why they serve. It's entitled, Art Ellison Has One Dying Wish, Feed All New Hampshire Students. Art Ellison isn't one to mince words. With a red blanket over his lap and a Support Public Education t-shirt on, he has one final request as he rests at the Granite VNA Hospice House. Quote, feed the damn kids, close quote, he said. Ellison, a three-term House Democrat from Concord, knows his days are numbered. When he entered hospice, the doctor told him he had between 2 days to 2 weeks to live. But that was 3.5 weeks ago. In his waning days, he's asked his colleagues in the State House to pass a bill that was the culmination of his 6 years in the legislature, increasing free and reduced lunch eligibility for dying children. It's a dying wish for an 80-year-old man who spent his career asking how he could leave things better for others, said his friend and fellow House Education Committee member, Mel Meyer. I would tag this as the Art Ellison Food for Kids Bill, said Meyer. He's always tried to focus on helping those who don't have a voice. Just over a month ago, the state representatives voted House Bill 1212 by a 193-17 margin in Ellison's absence. When Ellison introduced a similar bill in his first term, it failed by 2 votes. Anyway, they go on to talk about this piece of legislation, which is really quite remarkable. But what I want to talk a little bit is about Art Ellison, because I knew him because he was the head of adult education. And my first job after graduating from law school, I didn't want to practice law, was as the adult tutorial coordinator for Grafton County, and also as a low-income advocate. And Art Ellison always had my back. But what was so amazing to me about what Art did was that he was working with low income and low educated adults. He would do adult tutorial programs. He would teach them ESL. He would get them high school equivalency. But one of the things that he noticed was that as these adults would come into class to get their high school equivalency, was that they came in hungry. These are not children. These are adults. And he managed to figure out a way how to feed these hungry adults as they were trying to get their GEDs or their high school equivalency. Well, literally the day, 40 years after working as the head of adult education, he retires. You know what he did that afternoon? He filed to be a state rep that earns $100 a year. And what did he do as a state rep? He focused on feeding hungry kids. This is the man that's dying right now in hospice. This is a man who's a hero. He's not just a hero for New Hampshire. He's a hero for a country and should be recognized as such. All right, I'll stop crying. Anyway, so I've got Art in my head. And then I go to The Nation magazine and I read The Nation regularly. You know, we have John Nichols on all the time. John Nichols is an old friend. He's been covering me since I ran for governor in the early 1990s. And I saw a title and I'm like, oh my God, what's this about? It was Kentucky is about to pass the cruelest criminal justice bill in America. The state is making it easier to kill homeless people on private property. And that's just one part of one of the most draconian crime bills in recent history. Now, let me just set the stage. I believe that Kentucky is the 6th or 7th poorest state in the nation. In the nation. So there are a lot of people they could kill, okay? Because they've got a lot of them. And I went, you know, I got to learn more about this bill and I got to reach out to the two writers of it because it's written brilliantly, it's well-sourced, and it's just so incredibly sad. Paige Omek is a writer and fact-checker based in New York. Their writing has appeared in These Times, The American Prospect, and other sources. Rohan Montgomery is a researcher and writer based in New York. His work has appeared on the BBC, in The New Republic, and in These Times as elsewhere. And Paige and Rohan wrote this fabulous piece. Thank you both for joining me, and thank you for writing this. I really appreciate it. So I don't know even where to start, but I'm going to sort of randomly start with you, Paige. So tell me a little bit about Paige, but more importantly, tell me about this bill. And Rohan and Paige, I'm going to ask you sort of to figure out how to hold hands together since you wrote this story together, and share in the telling of it, because it is not just a story of Kentucky. It will be a story that is replicated by more conservative MAGA governors around the country, where they have supermajorities in their legislature. It is, in a lot of ways, we keep talking about what it will be like if Trump gets reelected. I'm just going to tell my audience, you don't have to wait. You have to go to places like Florida. You have to go to places like Texas. You have to go to places like Kentucky, because they are laying out exactly what it's like, and it's inhumane, and it's cruel, and it's blaming people that, frankly, policy has set up to fail. And once the policy has failed them, they then find an excuse to not only make them homeless, but in the case of Kentucky, maybe even to kill them. So Paige, welcome to the program, and set up this story for us so that we understand what Kentucky is doing, because even though they have a Democratic governor, they have supermajorities in their legislature, which means even though the state has sort of wanted a more softening and a more understanding policy, i.e. the governor, what they've elected with their legislature is incredibly harsh and draconian. And even though they may not want it, they may ultimately get it. So explain to us a little bit about what Kentucky is doing and about this bill that probably will pass and go to the desk of Andy Beshear.
Yeah, so thanks so much for having us on. Something that really interested me coming at this story was, before I understood the context of the supermajority, that, you know, Andy Beshear is being celebrated as an up-and-coming Democrat. I know the New Republic has an article of why he's maybe one of the most popular new politicians. So what a moment for a new politician to get to stand up and say what's right, which definitely isn't HB5, House Bill 5, which is this Safer Kentucky Act. But yeah, then doing the reporting, learning that he doesn't necessarily have his hands tied, but his veto, if he chooses to do so, will be mostly symbolic, was an intense thing to learn. And I think we definitely felt that inevitability in those conversations with organizers and advocates. But at the same time, I think also in those conversations, something related was that they feel that the state of Kentucky is punishing more blue dots in like Louisville in the state. So in Louisville, maybe, they've tried to pass certain rental protections. This bill would affect rental protections. You know, certain cities may try to have less draconian policies on, quote unquote, unlawful camping. But bills like HB5 are a way that states and, in this case, a Republican state, are able to wield their power onto cities.
So Rohan, I'm going to begin by reading the opening of your piece, because I think we need to get into the granular details of exactly what this bill does. And you're right. It is a way to almost increase criminal, what they're going to be defining as criminal activity in the blue dots, which are the cities. And if you understand anything about being a mayor, where there's a dense population and people need to live together and people need to feel safe and secure, you need to figure out, like anything else, when do you proceed with what would be perhaps criminal behavior, but is not really worthy of arrest, that there is another way to sort of bring the situation down. And I always, I talk about this all the time, and I'm not sure you're aware of this, but because we air in Houston, Texas, on a large station, I've learned so much about Texas. And what to me is so interesting about these blue dots, these more urban areas, is what they not only have learned to live with, but what they've learned to support, because they understand that they're sort of part and parcel of what makes the city. In Houston, Texas alone, Paige and Rohan, there are 600,000 undocumented immigrants. 600,000. I live next door to the state of Vermont. That's more than the entire state of Vermont. Well, why are those 600,000 not arrested? Why are they not perceived as a threat? Because in a lot of ways, they ultimately help to maintain the economy in Houston. They're crucial for this. So there is something on the books that says, oh, but this is an undocumented immigrant. You have perhaps the right to sort of, you know, arrest them or do whatever, but they don't. They don't. Even Governor Abbott doesn't, because he understands, but they sort of play this game. And Rohan, I'm just going to start with the opening of your article at The Nation, and then I want you to get into detail about this, about the House Bill 5. On March 14th, the Kentucky Senate Judiciary Committee voted to approve House Bill 5, the Safer Kentucky Act. The legislation will now head to the Senate floor for a vote, and it will most certainly pass. The 78-page bill criminalizes homelessness and decriminalizes the use of deadly force against individuals engaging in, quote, unlawful camping, close quote. Under this law, if a property owner believes an unhoused trespasser is attempting to commit a felony or attempting to, quote, dispossess them, they can shoot the homeless person. Wow. That puts a lot into the interpretation of someone who owns the property, Rohan. What does it mean to attempt to commit a felony, and how would you know it? And what does the word dispossess mean? I mean, in so many ways, as I'm looking at some of the language in House Bill 5, it almost feels like it should be void for vagueness, but it seems like vagueness is exactly their intent, Rohan.
I completely agree with you, and so too did a lot of the experts we spoke to, Paige and I, and they said one of the scariest things about this bill is that each specific situation will possibly have to just be tested in courts once someone actually interprets it for themselves. So for example, let's say an unhoused person is on a private property and they start a fire to cook their dinner. Well, what if the private property owner kills them and says, well, this person was clearly trying to commit arson on my property? What if a tenant, for example, a landlord wants to evict a tenant, but they refuse to leave? Is the tenant attempting to dispossess the landlord of their property? Does that mean they can be killed? I mean, the bill doesn't specify. So ultimately, it's going to have to play out and people are going to lose their lives. And maybe the court will decide the bill was wrong, but you know, people are actually going to suffer before we figure all of this out because of such a cruel and vague bill. Yeah.
So here's the other problem. So you're going to have to go to court to interpret it. Okay. But if you've shot someone and they're dead, you only have one person there to tell you the story. Okay. So you've already given the edge to the owner of the property who's now shot the person who's cooking a meal. In addition to which, if you're looking at, you know, the fact that someone may be homeless, they may not know that they're wandering on to private property, okay? They may not have any idea because it isn't well marked. We're talking rural Kentucky, possibly. We're talking Kentucky anyway. And, you know, everything doesn't have a fence that you climb over or whatever. So in a lot of ways, it is such a license for people to take what they claim is justice into their own hands. And, you know, I'm almost laughing because what has Donald Trump done to get out from under? He has used the justice system to deny and delay his ability to get to justice. Now what we're doing in Kentucky, Paige, is we're actually arming people so that they can decide when justice will be enacted, but their form of justice is murder. I mean, think about it. You trespass, not knowing maybe even that you're trespassing, but now because you trespass, you've now given a license for someone to kill you. It is like, it's not only shocking, but it's like, how can this be America when you've given that kind of finality to someone because you've put property rights over life rights?
Yeah, it's absolutely writing a kind of vigilantism into this state law. And it's not to say that Kentucky doesn't already have stand your ground laws. They obviously already do. As we reported, you know, people don't have to retreat before using deadly force and are immune to certain prosecution, and police are generally allowed to, you know, arrest. It's, you know, stand your ground laws already lead to an increase in gun homicides and violent death. So the fact that this bill, which is supposed to be decreasing violent crime in Kentucky, legalizing, further enhancing standard ground laws and writing in this insane use of, deadly force is definitely not going to make people safer in the state.
Well, and let me just go again. So I'm living in the state of New Hampshire. The state of New Hampshire has stopped giving, at least my city and a number of the cities has stopped giving out housing vouchers to low-income people in order for them to get, Section 8 housing or whatever. Do you know why? Because they now have like thousands of people who have vouchers, but they have nowhere to use them because there's no housing to use the voucher for. So it's not like they don't have even the ability to pay. They just don't have the shelter to use the ability to pay to get to the shelter. Now, this is New Hampshire. We're the seventh richest state in the nation, as opposed to Kentucky, which is one of the poorest states in the nation. So we're looking at both ends of the spectrum, Rohan. Rich or poor, you're screwed when it comes to finding a place to live. Okay, it just doesn't happen, all right? And so what I'm looking at is you have in House Bill 5, if it passes, sleeping outside in public or on private property would become unlawful camping. First offenders would be fined $250. Further offenses could result in a Class B misdemeanor and carries the same fine only up to 90 days in jail. Someone who just needs a bed could find themselves in a cycle of fines and jail time. All right. And local governments, this is the kicker about the blue dots that I heard from Paige. Local governments would be forbidden from preventing or discouraging enforcement of these provisions. So again, Rohan, what this really does is, so you have, private property owners could shoot and kill someone who happens to be homeless and on their property, but then private homeowners could actually go and say, wait a minute, that sheriff didn't arrest the guy who's sleeping in their car. So in a lot of ways, they're almost forcing the vigilantism from the bottom to now force local governments to do the things that they know makes no sense, doesn't make their city safer. Basically, it's criminalizing activity that's really more based on poverty than anything that even remotely resembles criminal activity. And yet, that's exactly what they want to do. If you don't have a place to live, then guess what? Not only can you be shot, but where are these people going to go? What do they do? They're caught between a rock and a hard place. There's not enough homeless shelters. There's not enough place for them to live. They're poor. I mean, what are they going to do? Poof, disappear? No, they're now going to give a license to some private property owner to kill them, as if that is in any way, shape, or form a solution, Rohan.
Well, it's fundamentally a question of, do you want to help pull people up the ladder or do you want to pull the ladder up behind you? People don't have housing across the country from Kentucky to California, and you have basically two choices. You make more housing for them, or you put in all of these sort of crazy bills like HB 5, which effectively punish people for not being able to access housing. And as we mentioned in the piece, jailing people for the crime of not being able to find a house, for trying to survive is actually incredibly expensive. It's cheaper to just build more houses. I think in Kentucky alone, the Bail Project talks about how they've saved, millions and millions and millions of dollars of taxpayer money by getting people out of jail, who were thrown in there for basically crimes which you could even argue don't deserve jail time. And so Kentucky has made the choice not only to ruin thousands of people's lives by throwing them in jail, they're going to cost the state possibly even like $1 billion over the next sort of few years in increased costs of keeping these people locked up, keeping more people locked up for longer periods of time with fewer opportunities to post bail. Because over half of K Kentuckians can't afford to pay their cash bail. And the bill also restricts bail organizations from posting that bail. And we all know how much even a short time in jail can just ruin your life completely. So it's just creating this cycle of violence and increased costs, both social and economic. It's really dreadful.
Well, you write, a 2021 Prison Policy Initiative study found that if Kentucky were a country, listen to this, if Kentucky were a country, it would already have the seventh highest rate of incarceration. That's if it were a country. I mean, we're talking like the world, all right? So I just want people to understand. And incarceration, as you point out, Rohan, is not cheap. It is not cheap. But they, in some ways, don't, not only do they not care, but we already know that they've already seen that it says many jails in Kentucky are already over 100% capacity. From 2000 to 2019, the number of local inmates held in the state on an average day more than doubled. So I guess I'm going to ask you, Paige. So we know they're at overcapacity, which means they don't have a bed for them, the way we don't have housing for folks. I mean, there's this continuum of no place to go, okay, whether it's in prison or on the street. And then you have the idea that they've doubled the number of people that have been incarcerated. Well, if they've doubled the number of people, shouldn't Kentucky be incredibly safer? But it isn't. It isn't. So obviously there's a connect the dots problem here, because they keep going into either killing them or warehousing them in prison, none of which has improved the housing situation, the poverty situation, the safety situation. I mean, talk about like a Molotov cocktail. That's exactly what House Bill 5 is. It blows things up and it fixes nothing. It fixes nothing in a state that is the sixth or seventh poorest state in the nation. If anyone should be sensitive to poverty, it should be Kentucky. But Kentucky's answer is, just shoot them. You know, it is shocking. So are we getting the sense that this very well-admired Kentucky governor, who knows, obviously, that there's an override capacity, will he use this as an opportunity not only to point out everything that's in your article? He should just basically read your article out loud, as far as I'm concerned. But that's something that's my recommendation, not necessarily yours. But is he going to use this as an eloquent moment to talk not only about how wrong this is for Kentucky, but that this is a template for a nation? And if we do this as a nation, not only do we lose our humanity, not only do we lose our sense of justice and integrity, but that basically what we are doing is we're aiding and abetting something that will justify the kind of behavior we're hearing coming out of Donald Trump at every single speech, because we will have already laid the foundation for it, and Kentucky will be part and parcel for that.
Well, if Andy Beshear wants to do that, sounds like he'll probably be one of the first Democrats to do it, you know, to speak out on behalf of, you know, the poor and the homeless. You know, as we've seen across the country, Democratic governors and mayors have not been doing a lot better by their, you know, for their most struggling citizens. London Breed in San Francisco was begging the GOP Supreme Court to take up this case that would, it does very similar things, you know, that, you know, she would like to sweep homeless people even if there's nowhere else for them to go, right? And she was begging the Supreme Court, as well as Gavin Newsom, Portland's governor, Portland's mayor. Democrats across the country are finding themselves just as guilty and finding themselves using the same talking points as Republicans around the so-called crime wave, around this lack of safety in the world. And I'll admit, you know, obviously, I think that people can feel, you know, there's a discomfort with visible poverty. There's a discomfort when we see people sleeping on the streets, right? And there is action that needs to be taken. But partnering up with the Supreme Court, with think tanks like the Cicero Institute, who are working with over 20 states across this country to pass legislation like HB5, is not the solution that anyone should be seeking. And I would love to see Kentucky's governor stand up and veto this.
So. Not only do I want Andy to do it, but Rohan, I've said this ad nauseum. If I ever ran for office again, my entire campaign would be three words. And you know what the three words are? Do the math. Do the math. So if you don't want to be humane, if you don't want to talk about justice, let's talk about dollars. Let's talk about cash. Let me just break this down for you. You know, I mean, all the good reasons that you shouldn't do it, the sort of Christian reasons, the Judeo-Christian ethic, I'll put all that to the back of the bus, because we don't believe what Jesus said anyway. So now let's just do the math and let's just do raw economics. And frankly, if Andy Beshear wants to start, he can start by saying, there's a lot of reasons I could talk about the inhumanity of this bill, but I'm going to do the math problem for you. And if I do the math problem for you, then do me a favor, make sure that they don't override my veto. Because this is stupid economically for Kentucky. And you know what? If we could put this money into something that would not only stabilize our economy, it would actually enhance our economy. It could do all these things. Instead, this is wrong on every level. It is wrong on every level. And that's the other thing that I read from your article is this is just bad economics. This just drains all your public dollars in a way that sees no benefit and only enhances liability. And I think that on top of the inhumanity of it is just bad math. It is just bad math. Thank you so much for writing this incredibly comprehensive, frightening, frightening article at The Nation magazine. I hope it gets the attention it deserves. I hope Andy Beshear, I'm going to send it to him because I want him to read it. I hope he uses part of it in his veto of this bill. It's entitled, "Kentucky is about to pass the cruelest criminal justice bill in America. The state is making it easier to kill homeless people on private property." And that's just one part of one of the most draconian crime bills in recent history. Paige Olmec and Rohan Montgomery, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And keep writing these stories, and I will constantly try to share them with my national audience. So again, thank you so much. This, everyone, is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute.
Trump said that Jews who don't vote for him hate Israel and hate their religion. I should point out that the overwhelming majority of American Jews have voted against him every time he has been on the ballot and will vote against him again this November. I am also not going to waste any more of my time explaining why comments like that are offensive, dangerous, and anti-Semitic, nor am I going to waste any more of my time explaining why it is particularly striking that he made those comments while speaking to Sebastian Gorka, who belongs to organizations or did belong to organizations in Hungary with Nazi ties. What I am going to say is this. There was a lot of hand-wringing earlier this year about anti-Semitism on the left, particularly on the college campuses. And we should be clear, anti-Semitism on the left is a problem, and so is anti-Semitism on the right. And anybody who only sees it on the other side, and I'm looking at you, people like Elsie Stefanik, if you are a progressive and only see right-wing anti-Semitism, or you are a MAGA and only see left-wing anti-Semitism, you don't care about Jews, and you are part of the problem. And Donald Trump is a big part of the anti-Semitism problem in the United States. And anybody who denies that is putting partisanship and their fascist agenda way ahead of what is possibly good for the Jews.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
Are frozen embryos children? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The recent Alabama case involved embryos created in vitro and accidentally destroyed at the fertility clinic where they were being preserved. There, as is typical in vitro fertilization, an egg and a sperm were joined in a lab to create an embryo that can be stored for decades. The adult sued under the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, and the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that the fact that the embryos had existed only in a lab and had never been implanted in a uterus was irrelevant. They said that the laboratory embryos were children, unborn children, regardless of their, in the court's words, location. The rationale? Life begins at fertilization. Those fertilized eggs in the lab were children, unborn children, in the Chief Justice's words, little people. In response to the in vitro decision, the Alabama legislature passed a law that protects IVF clinics from lawsuits. But the Alabama case and its rationale remain. Under Dobbs, that's the Supreme Court case that reversed Roe v. Wade, women no longer have the right to make their own reproductive choices. That decision is now up to the government. So, what used to be a woman's right to choose is now a matter of legislative roulette. And as the croupier says at the table, round and round she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom...
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? matters are to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do, when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping, and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Monday morning. So I remember when DeSantis was running for president. I guess I'm glad that he wasn't successful, but what did that mean? We still have Trump. So DeSantis was trying to move to the right of Trump, if that was even possible. But at one point, DeSantis wanted to make America like Florida. And I thought, well, then if that's the case, and DeSantis and Trump are sort of like on the same page on so many issues, I think we need to continue to sort of follow what Florida is like. So we kind of get an idea of what, you know, what the future of America would look like. And therefore we go back and we grab Andres Croy, who's the communications director for Florida Watch and DeSantis Watch, which is an accountability project. And Andres, I want to welcome you back to the program, but you know, I never really wanted to live in Florida. And the more I read about what DeSantis and the legislature is doing is, I don't know how people stay in Florida. That's the part that, and it's so sad for people that have lived there their whole lives, their second and third generation, people like yourself, who are watching your state just become, it's almost becoming a conservative joke in the sense that it's doing things that if you had just laid this out on a piece of paper and you want to do a sitcom about it, they'd say, no, this is too crazy. But it's not too crazy because it's becoming the law in Florida. And one of the stories that grabbed my attention right away, and I want to start here, even though it maybe isn't the most important one, but maybe to some extent it is an important one. And it was the fact that the NAACP is now warning Black athletes across the United States, don't even think about applying to a college or a university in Florida. And I'm reading this and I'm going, if it ain't good for Black athletes, why is it good for anybody else? You know, I'm just thinking about like, what makes them the only people that should be worried about this? But in a lot of ways, you see this as a really important story because it isn't just limited to how people are looking at college sports, but it is about I'm going to use the expression ka-ching, because this is so important to how Florida both defines itself from a winning strategy when it comes to college sports, but also how it also is a huge revenue producer. And if you're going to hurt Florida in any way, shape, or form, go where the money is. And to a large extent, that's what the NAACP has done.
Yeah, and good morning, Arnie. Thank you for having me back and for the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners again. This story is very important. And I think the first thing to note here is that this advisory from the NAACP when it comes to student athletes does come on the back of their overall travel advisory that they issued last year for all Black Americans coming to our state due to the overwhelmingly racist, anti-Black policies that have been coming from Governor DeSantis and out of the legislature here in Florida. What they've done now by banning DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in our state colleges and universities is an attack on all students of a minority background. But what the NAACP chooses to focus on here is important for a reason that you mentioned. Our governor and our legislature are, by and large, still controlled by their big money donors. The big money donors in the state of Florida who fund a lot of the legislators, a lot of the governor and his priorities and political ambitions, those are also the same people who are boosters at the major universities in the state of Florida. Now, for you and your listeners who do not live in the South, I can tell you that college football season is a religion down here. It is one of the most important things that happens in the South every Saturday in the fall. I myself am a huge fan of the Florida Gators, and I every Saturday you will find me on the couch for 3.5 hours watching the Gators play no matter what is going on. So by telling student athletes, and I really want to give a lot of credit here to Emmitt Smith, who is the NFL's all-time leading rusher, a Florida Gator legend, who came out after the University of Florida abolished its DEI department and said this is wrong, and issued a warning to Black student athletes considering the University of Florida and those who are already at colleges and universities in the state to speak out, because this affects everybody. And when you are a young athlete, a Black athlete especially, who is considering where you want to go to college, where you want to get your education, you know, many of those folks are not going to play pro ball. So what they would like to do, and even the ones who do end up playing professional sports at a higher level, they need classes. They need ways to learn about entrepreneurship, about business, to make connections with folks who can help them move on in that next phase of their life. By abolishing DEI, you're getting rid of things that that are extremely helpful to folks like that. Like things like Black entrepreneurship classes, places that you can connect with other people who can help you start a business, who can help you learn how to manage your money. These are all things that are extremely important when students are considering where to go to school. But more than that, if Black student athletes stop coming to universities in the state of Florida, this hurts the bottom line of the football programs. This makes the boosters stand up and pay attention. This makes the people who have the big money in our state look at the governor and the legislature and say, hey, you're not only hurting students now and student athletes and you know, all minority students in the state of Florida, you're also hurting our bottom line, and you're hurting our ability to go enjoy major college football every Saturday. And it's an unfortunate thing to say, but so much of policy in this country is still dictated by where the money goes. And one of the best ways to enact change is to make sure that those people who write the checks, who have the big, deep pockets, are feeling the hurt. And that's what this policy should hopefully do, while at the same time opening people's eyes to the incredible, hateful, and recursive policies that have been pushed by this governor and this legislature that are hurting all students across the state of Florida.
You just may have heard me talk in the first half of the show about what's going on in Kentucky. And I said my entire speech would, if I ever ran for higher office, would be do the math. So I'm going to just do a little math about football and Florida. So I happened to Google something because you mentioned the Florida Gators. And it turns out that the coach of the Florida Gators came to Florida in 2022 with initial salary. This is a football coach at a public university. Can I tell you what his initial salary is? $7.1 million a year. That is the salary of the football coach at a public university. That salary is set to increase by $100,000 in each of the 7 years his contract runs through, so that at the end of 7 years, his deal will be worth, this is for a college football coach, $51.8 million. Now, has anyone talked to the Gator coach about what the NAACP is recommending to a potential football players who might come to Florida? I don't know what the Black, white, Chicano, Hispanic, whatever it is, makeup is of the Florida football team for the Florida Gators, but I suspect there may be a number of people of color that are playing on that team. What he thinks of what the NAACP is recommending, because you can give him all the money in the world, but if he can't recruit good players, he's screwed, honey. He's screwed. And that $51.8 million just went up in smoke.
And I have a lot of thoughts on Coach Napier that are probably for a different podcast, Arnie. I will say that, you know, this does hurt our program. It hurts the college football program at the University of Florida. You know, these are being, this policy, this getting rid of DEI, obviously was dictated by state law, by our board of governors here. But it was enacted by Ben Sasse, who is the university president at Florida now, who is, of course, the former Nebraska senator who was brought to Florida in what is now a secret process, because a couple years ago, the legislature passed a law and the governor signed it that no longer makes our university college presidential searches public. These are now done in private. So we find out who the president is at the end of a private search instead of having that play out in the sunshine as it should and as it did in the past. But it's not just football that gets hurt by this, right? The University of Florida football team makes up the majority of revenue to the athletic department every single year. Of course. You're not only hurting revenue for a sport like football, you're hurting revenue for other sports like track and field, like swimming, water polo, a lot of women's sports that don't generate the same amount of massive amounts of revenue that football and to some extent basketball do at the university. And that's not just at Florida, that's at every university, especially public universities in the South overall. It's going to make it harder for coaches. I think it's going to reach a tipping point here where they're going to have to stand up and say something. Yes. And speak out on behalf of their student athletes and the kids who play for them, who put in the work week in and week out, who do those 6 a.m. practices, who go to study hall, who work in that harsh Florida heat in the afternoons during spring practice to get ready to go play every Saturday when the season counts in August and September and October. There's a lot of moving parts here, and there's a lot of people who need to speak up because it's in the best interest of not only themselves, but of the student athletes who do all of the work that make them a bit, that make it their ability to get those huge salaries that you talked about.
I know. But as you were, as soon as you mentioned the Florida Gators, I'm like, I wonder what they're paying the coach. It's like that. I immediately Googled that. So we'll get beyond this in the NAACP. But this is a great hook because in a lot of ways, you know, you would like to talk about the immorality of this or the morality of that or the inhumanity of this. But in the end, you have to go, as you point, to where the money is. And unfortunately, when you're talking about sports and you're talking about Florida and you're talking about college, it's where the money is. So let's talk a little bit about the New Republic article. Florida's legislature has outdone itself this time. Lawmakers voted to ban lab meat and keep teenagers working in heat waves rather than tackle the state's collapsing insurance market. Okay, Anders, this is your bread and butter. It's what you do all the time. So let's talk a little bit about how bad it was in this Florida legislature. And sadly, it could have been worse. I mean, which is hard to imagine, but it could have been worse. So sort of tick off a little bit about what they did and what they accomplished. Because again, I want to remind everyone, Ron DeSantis, when he was running for president for 16 and a half minutes, wanted to make America like Florida. So I just want to make sure you understand what that means. And now I feel sorry for everybody I know that lives in Florida. So walk us through a couple of things that happened, because I've been reading a number of editorials and everyone was like, oh my God, oh my God. But yet this is what they elected. Now the question is, can they live with it?
You know, I want to touch on what you said there first, because it could have been worse this year. But yeah. I want to give a major shout out because progressives did claim numerous victories protecting the freedoms of Floridians this session. Through the hard work of people who organized, who showed up, who testified at committee, who protested, who called legislators, we were able to stop a lot of harmful legislation that would have put public safety at risk, attacked LGBTQ plus and local communities, right, and lowered wages for workers. But, you know, there were bills that would have made it illegal to remove Confederate monuments. They tried to roll back and repeal hard-fought gun safety reforms that were passed after the tragedy at Parkland that would have allowed teenagers to once again buy assault rifles. I think the last time I was on your show, we talked about the abuser empowerment bill. That was another step back for protecting reproductive freedom here in the state. Well, those bills died, and they died because people showed up and they made their voices heard and they fought. But as you mentioned, this legislative session was really another missed opportunity for the people of Florida whose priorities continue to not be addressed. You know, as working families and seniors in our state continue to struggle with an affordability crisis, we have the highest property and auto insurance rates in the country. We have out of control housing costs. We have skyrocketing utility bills. We have Republican leadership who are focused on their own political ambitions and the needs of their corporate elite donors instead of the working people and seniors who they are actually elected to represent. So what does that look like? That looks like the bill that you're talking about, where they rolled back child labor protections in the state. That bill was pushed by the Foundation for Government Accountability, which is based out of Naples. Their founder has done press conferences with Governor DeSantis. They've given a lot of money to Republican leadership here in the state of Florida. You talked about banning lab-grown meat in the state. I don't think that was a priority for anyone in Florida who is worried about how they're going to put food on the table. They certainly weren't worried about banning a source of it. It is just an absurd amount of things that we're dealing with here. The property insurance crisis at the top of that list. When you talk to Floridians, the number one thing they're talking about is they cannot afford property insurance. They cannot afford to stay in their homes. One of the reasons for that is because we are ground zero for the climate crisis. Right. We are a peninsula that sticks out hundreds of miles into the ocean. We are hit by devastating hurricanes with regularity here. These drive up our costs of the property insurance. And instead of doing anything to deal with the climate crisis, instead of putting in place new laws and regulations that could protect us, that could put us on a clean energy future, that could make sure that we are protecting ourselves from these upcoming disasters, what did we do instead? Well, we passed a law this legislative session that removes the part of our statutes that refer to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. We removed that from Florida statute. So instead of actually confronting these issues, we are doing the bidding of the giant fossil fuel companies, people who are, again, corporate elite donors to Republicans and the governor here in the state of Florida, by putting our head in the sand and refusing to work on real solutions that will help people's pocketbook, that will allow us to preserve and protect Florida's environmental treasures for generations to come. But that is okay, because we also made it easier for children to work longer hours and to not have to deal with climate change here in the state.
We've been talking a lot about insurance, in part because of just the geography of Florida in light of the climate crisis. And we've seen tripling of insurance bills. So I am looking at the New Republic article, and I'm just trying to figure out whether this is going to have any kind of significant impact on costs and fees. Rising property insurance rates, meanwhile, might be Florida's most pressing pocketbook issue. Lawmakers did pass a handful of reform measures to deal with the state's mounting property insurance crisis this session. Those include a temporary pause on taxes and fees on flood and property insurance premiums. Well, that's a revenue device. Moving policies for second homes away from the state's beleaguered public insurer onto the private market, and matching grants to homeowners who fortify their homes against storms. So all these things are good. Do they kick in before the new hurricane season, or do they wait? I'm just sort of curious. Again, the idea that you've passed some reforms is a good thing. When those reforms actually become law and go into effect are really important. The question is, does it happen before the hurricane season or after the hurricane season? And then I even have to ask this question. It's just pathetic.
Well, what the governor and Republican leadership did is they trimmed around the edges. None of these policies, none of these reforms that you talked about are going to have a major impact on the cost of property insurance here in the state of Florida.
Right.
The big one that they've been talking about was a proposal from the governor to cut taxes on property insurance premiums here in the state of Florida. Well, that money actually mostly goes back into the pockets of the insurance companies. On average, a Floridian will see a savings of about $62, I believe, on their property insurance premium this year, which in a state with an average property insurance premium of over $6,000 is a drop in the bucket. I saw one news report where a Floridian called that a slap in the face to him in terms of what he is paying overall. The My Safe Florida Home program is great if you have the money to already pay upfront to upgrade your home. Those are matching grants that help people who can afford $10,000 already to do things like upgrade into storm-resistant windows, upgrade their roof, things like that. The state will match that dollar for dollar, but you have to be able to pay that cost up front.
Exactly. That's always the problem. Exactly.
Many Floridians who are working seniors, they can't afford that cost up front, right? They need help to make that work overall. You know, and the last thing is, the governor on Friday was asked about this, and he said that he's not going to sit down and push the property insurance companies to lower rates because that's not how a market works. Well, this is a governor who has prided himself time and time again on his ability to bully private industry, bully private companies, bully legislatures, bully everybody who gets in the way of his agenda. But I think Floridians should really take note, and Americans across the country should take note, that when Ron DeSantis doesn't want to bully you, he won't, because Ron DeSantis and his Republican allies have taken more than $10 million from the insurance industry over just the last 5 years, which is influencing their ability to work on behalf of consumers who are getting hammered with these cost increases, while at the same time, they've given $3 billion in bailouts to the property insurance companies who continue to jack our rates up while refusing to even sit down with them and try to push them to lower rates, which is, by the way, something that elected officials in California, in Louisiana, other states that are dealing with an increase in natural disasters have done. They have called roundtables. They have called these insurance companies in to sit down and figure out, how do we do this? How do we lower rates? What is the best way to do this? We're not seeing any of that action here in Florida. And Arnie, for your folks up in New Hampshire, the one thing you did talk about there, pushing people off of Citizens policies for snowbirds, for people who own second homes in the state of Florida, you'll now be pushed out of your Citizens policy if you like that policy, our state-backed insurer here in the state of Florida. And you can now be put on unregulated surplus lines insurance plans here in the state. That means that if that insurance company goes under and they can't pay your plan, they can't pay to rebuild your home, there is nobody backing that money anymore. You are going to be out of luck and unable to rebuild, because the state of Florida has decided that instead of dealing with this problem by holding insurance companies accountable, by making sure we're putting consumers first, we're putting the needs of the people who are writing the campaign checks first here in Florida.
Let's talk about public education, because education in a lot of ways, with, you know, starting with the new school and all the things that they have done, is always something that people pay a lot of attention to. We started out with the NAACP, which is really technically a story about education, but not necessarily so much. So I'm looking at an article from Florida Politics. House tees up communist history lessons for final vote, rejects bid to add January 6th or McCarthyism into the curriculum. So now, how are we indoctrinating children? And what are we doing with the discussion of communism, which I think is so interesting, because in a lot of ways, we see Donald Trump having this love affair with Putin. And although Putin isn't technically a communist per se, he really wants to go back to that communist agenda. And in fact, I think, you know, to a large extent, they would find a lot of affinity between what Trump wants to do vis-a-vis Putin. And yet, what are we doing? We're teeing up history lessons on communism. So tell me a little bit about what's happening with public education in the state of Florida, because it sounds a bit terrifying and a bit more like indoctrination.
You hit the nail on the head. What we have seen time and time again is that when Ron DeSantis says he wants education, not indoctrination, he wants the right indoctrination.
Yes,
the indoctrinator in chief, governor in this entire country, is Ron DeSantis here in the state of Florida. They have pushed policies like we talked about with getting rid of DEI here in our state schools, the Don't Say Gay and Trans law that passed. And once again, time and again, we've also seen with the new civics curriculum, there were teacher training courses that were offered to give teachers here in the state of Florida a bonus if they took them. Turns out those courses were put together by Hillsdale College. Downplayed the impact that slavery had in the state, downplayed the effects of racism in our overall system here in the country. This is part and parcel of the Republican plan, which is to make sure that schools are indoctrination factories with the facts, with the history that they want to teach students, not to allow for the open collaboration, the ability and the freedom to learn that we count on for our public schools, and to make sure that our kids are getting all the tools that they need to succeed in life. Florida's teachers, Florida's educators, our school professionals, they are putting in the hard work every single day in an underfunded system, by the way. We are still in the bottom 10 when it comes to teacher pay in this country. We're in the bottom 5, I believe, in per pupil funding, to make sure that our children are given the resources that they need to learn, to advance, to make sure that they are able to get the education that will allow them to succeed in the world. But time and time again, they are being put up against a governor and a Republican legislature more interested in pushing politics into the classroom than allowing our children the freedom to learn what they need to succeed in life.
So I saw a headline and I swore, this has got to be not real. This has got to be from The Onion. And here is the headline. Florida Senate passes one per month limit on book challenges. And I'm reading this going, what? They're putting a limit on book challenges. Well, let me sort of again set the stage for folks to understand that when you're thinking about Florida, the new bumper sticker should be book banning is us, okay? Because they're the gods of book banning. Listen to this. In the 2022-2023 school year, PEN America recorded 1,406 book ban cases in Florida, which accounted for 40% of all the book bans in America. In America, the next state with the most book ban cases with Texas, with a mere 625. I mean, this is like how much wasted time, how much energy is going into book bans, but where are they coming up with this idea of like one book ban a month? Like, who are they banning? What are they banning? What's the point of this? And I think we know that a lot of parents may be concerned about maybe the books that their children are reading, but the people that are actually like requesting the book bans don't even have kids that go to school in those districts, and yet they have the ability to attempt to ban a book. So sort of walk us through a little bit about this, because this is a horror show.
Well, the governor asked for it and the legislature passed these incredibly vague laws when it comes to how banning books would work here in the state of Florida. And as you said, it's gotten out of hand. We are leading the nation in book bans. We have had one person in Escambia County, another person, I believe, on the Space Coast, who have done the vast majority of book ban attempts here in the state of Florida. We've seen Moms for Liberty chapters throughout the state circulating ban lists that we will then see pop up at different school board meetings all across the state of Florida. And what they've started to realize is that this is a political problem for them, that actually people don't like book bans. They like it when their children have the ability to access books in their school library, when their teachers have the ability to give them books that expand on the things that they learn in the classroom. So this attempt now to roll back the ability of people to challenge books at a large scale, the way we've seen across the state, is a direct reaction to the political realities that these book bans are unpopular. And what they've done is hurting public education here in the state. And parents are rightly standing up and saying, I want more resources in my child's classroom, not more book bans.
Oh, Anders, we could have you on for 10 hours. We're talking about Florida politics. We're talking about Florida legislation. And who do we go to? We go to Anders Croy. Anders Croy is the communications director for Florida Watch and DeSantis Watch. Thank you so much. And I have an extra room in my house if you ever need to move. Just telling you. Yes, telling you. This, everyone, is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producer Dave Scott, Steffi Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You better-